Hi, good afternoon. My name's Elise, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Wow. Hey. I first want to just say that I really owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom, God willing, will celebrate 31 years sober on April 5th. And I basically got to cut my teeth in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a big part of my story, and I just want to say thank you all. And it's an honor to be here, to be asked. Thank you, Anne, for thinking of me. It's always a great opportunity to be a vessel, to carry the message for this program. Whew. I haven't been up in a podium in a long time. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. And also, I like to include a piece of Al-Anon literature just in case you don't get anything from what I say. And this, I was slow in coming to the Al-Anon literature. I really am, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is my source literature. Growing up in this fellowship, I was told, you know, that I could take what I like and leave the rest. And I've done a spiritual journey. I mean, you name it, I've tried it, from dancing in Indian powwows to Mormon temples to I've explored. And I've come back full circle, and really the 12 steps, 12 traditions and 12 concepts are my spiritual lens. But there is some really awesome Al-Anon literature. And I do understand today that there's a need for the separateness. But what I picked, actually, is the three views of Al-Anon: Alcoholics Speak to the Family. So, and I remember the first time I heard this letter. It's an open letter from an alcoholic to their family. And it goes, "I'm an alcoholic. I need your help. Don't lecture, blame, or scold me. You wouldn't be angry at me for having cancer or diabetes. Alcoholism is a disease, too. Don't pour out my liquor. It's just a waste, because I can always find ways of getting more. Don't let me provoke your anger. If you attack me verbally or physically, you will only confirm my bad opinion about myself. I hate myself enough already. Don't let your love and anxiety for me lead you into doing what I ought to do for myself. If you assume my responsibilities, you make my failure to assume them permanent. My sense of guilt will be increased, and you will feel resentful. Don't accept my promises. I'll promise anything to get off the hook. But the nature of my illness prevents me from keeping my promises, even though I mean them at the time. Don't believe everything I tell you. It may be a lie. Denial of reality is a symptom of my illness. Moreover, I'm likely to lose respect for those I can fool too easily. Don't make empty threats. Once you have made a decision, stick to it. Don't let me take advantage of you or exploit you in any way. Love cannot exist for long without the dimension of justice. Don't cover up for me or try in any way to spare me the consequences of my drinking. Don't lie for me, pay my bills, or meet my obligations. It may avert or reduce the very crisis that would prompt me to seek help. I can continue to deny that I have a drinking problem as long as you provide an automatic escape for the consequences of my drinking. Above all, do learn all you can about alcoholism and your role in relation to me. Go to open AA meetings when you can. Attend Al-Anon meetings regularly. Read the literature and keep in touch with Al-Anon members. They're the people who can help you see the whole situation clearly. I love you, your alcoholic." And that pretty much sums up all that we do when we don't have a program, those of us who've been affected by this disease. And you best believe this disease can cut through generations. I've been around, I remember first not thinking I really had a seat in Al-Ateen when I started. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, but, you know, because my mother was sober at the time. But since I've been around, I've seen it affect people who haven't had an active alcoholic in their life for years. It comes down to the generations, and then usually, because we love alcoholics, we find ourselves one. So, well, alcoholics are fun when they're sober, and I do love me some alcoholics, and I actually feel very comfortable in AA meetings. I often say that, you know, I knew chapter 5 before the alphabet. It's really a lullaby to me. I feel very at home. I grew up in speaker meetings. My mom's home group was the Burbank group in Burbank, California. And I remember we went back for to celebrate her 20 years. And there's a picture we did where she was at a podium like this at her home group. And I was 1 year old giving her her 1 year cake. And we reenacted that at 20 years. And there's a picture that I framed for her, me as one and me older, giving her her cake. And those people were like my family. Alcoholism ravaged, she was an only child, ravaged her life. And so I didn't have a lot of family, didn't have a lot of extended family. But the people there knew me. They were my family, my aunts and uncles and great aunts and great uncles and grandmas and getting passed around the room and loving on me. And I remember my brother and I, we were so used to being around people that loved us that, you know, my brother would get teased that he would just walk up to anyone and give them a kiss or a hug. And that's from growing up around here. But I was to have my own journey with the effects of this disease. Because you can't get it by osmosis. You can't get it just by being around. I mean, you can have a real loving feeling, but when that disease, the effects of that disease hit you, you need the tools of this program. And for me, tell you a little bit about my early childhood. I was adopted, and the diseases in my family, both in my biological family and my adopted family, my mom and dad got married, and could not get pregnant. And so they were actually looking to adopt a baby from Vietnam. And my dad was approached by one of his business partners who had a 15-year-old who was pregnant. And he was actually a raging alcoholic, the dad. And my birth mother hid her pregnancy. I'm actually an interracial baby. I'm Lebanese and I'm German. And she hid that relationship. She's blonde and blue-eyed. I have her nose. I got to meet her when I was 18, but I'll get to that. And my mom actually 12-stepped her dad into Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was a private adoption, and I was born. And they tell me the story that when they announced that the adoption was final, that I squealed in court. So I had alcoholism in my birth family, alcoholism in my adopted family. And my mom was had already made it to the program by then. But we were in crazy early sobriety. And actually, she had 10 years. And then when I was probably 2, when my brother was an infant, her mom was dying of cancer. And she started taking her morphine. And back then they didn't really talk about drugs in AA. And so she was still going to meetings, doing the stuff, and finally just said, I can't take it anymore, and went out, bought some alcohol. And I tell you that, you know, she's let me, given me permission to tell part of her early story, because I remember being a little kid in early sobriety with my mom. And my mom told me that my dad got a 502. We're from California, so that's a drunk driving, when they were first married, and then he just quit. So the jury's still out if he's an alcoholic. I know that he was a rageaholic, and I know we used to get lectures about the evils of alcohol and how you miss out on the present for hours, and I'd be like, Dad, just have a drink, you know? But the way, for me, that started the behavior of an Al-Anon is that I had a little brother, and I learned very quickly how to take the temperature of the room, how to know how the door was turning, what kind of mood my dad was in, and that I was responsible. No one told me that I was responsible. We were latchkey kids, so there was a lot. My mom, when they divorced when I was 2, and my mom didn't want us to be welfare kids, so she gave us to our dad for a year. It was just going to be a year until she could get back on her feet. And that turned into 7 years with my dad. So we were, and he was away on business trips a lot, and so we had to be with a babysitter that lived around the block. And but my dad, I mean, he did the best he could, and I made him wrong for a long time. But you all in this program, and I'll get to that too, but helped heal that relationship. But Anyway, we were young and latchkey kids. My brother was 7 with ADD bouncing off the walls, and I was 9. And I was cleaning the house and making dinner and walking us home. And when my dad got upset, he would hit my brother. And I didn't know the background of this growing up. I didn't know that there was a difference made between me and my brother. Later, I was to learn that, you know, these two parents that couldn't conceive, when they split up, my mom got pregnant with my brother. And so I think my dad took that very personally for a long time. And there was a difference made. I mean, I was their little girl that they made a choice to adopt, and my brother was this evidence of, you know, he was the one. But growing up, I didn't know all that. I just knew that my dad would always pair us together and my mom and my brother together. You know, we were alike and they were, you know, the odd ones and the ones that couldn't get it together. And I carried that guilt and I tried to make up for it with my brother. So I tried to shield him from things. And that's where the character developed of, you know, I mean, you guys have experienced an Al-Anon, good Al-Anon in your life, you know, do this for me. You're not doing it fast enough. You're not doing it right. Come on. I'll just do it, you know. And my brother learned that very quickly, you know, clean your room. And we'd go, and he wasn't doing it right. And he knew he could mess around a little bit, and then I'd take over and do it. Go out and play. I'll do it. So I learned how to be a martyr very young, 9 years old growing up. I also learned that I could get a lot of acknowledgement from doing in school. So I became a human doing and an overachiever. And, you know, I was bright and in the gifted program. But I still always felt like my skin was too tight. That's a saying that I heard in Alateen the first time. You know, my skin was too tight and I didn't quite fit in no matter, you know, when I was a little chubby kid. And, you know, not very athletic. I tried to play soccer and, my dad, God bless him, one time told me I wasn't athletic. And so that sunk in. And I stopped doing all kinds of sports. And he's a good guy. I mean, he didn't even remember this stuff later when I did my 9th step and we talked. He did the best he could with what he had. And he was a single parent, really. So life progressed and we moved and I was in junior high. And my mom would come and live with us for the summer. She was always a big presence in our life. She'd come to the school functions, and she, you know, she really tailored her life to be available for us when she could. But my dad was the primary parent. He had the higher income, and by that time we were established in school, and they didn't want to pull us out. And so that 1 year, like I said, turned into 7 years. Well, some things happened. That babysitter that we went to, we found out that there was some abuse going on toward my brother and some other stuff. So we were yanked out of that situation by my mom. And she was like, "You're coming to live with me. I don't care." And that began my rebellion. And she said, "You're going to go to Alateen for 6 months." Well, let me back up. I was living this double life. I was this honor student, straight A's. I could give you a snapshot. But inside, I never felt like I quite fit in. And then just to add another layer of that, I struggled a lot with my racial identity. I had experiences that happened very young to me where people that I was close with, where I was ashamed of being white. Real powerful, potent, racist experiences that shaped my childhood. And I remember from being very young saying, "This isn't right." And I remember, you know, reading Malcolm X. And, you know, I share that is because there was a lot of things I didn't feel comfortable about. And also, a lot of identity issues, which we'll get into later. So I was always trying to fit in. So here I am in Anaheim, which if any of you know, Anaheim, California, it's like the big red dot in the liberal state. Just like Atlanta's the big blue island. And anyways, so I'm there. I'm radical. You know, I'm like hanging with the crowd that is the bad crowd. They call me Mama Elise, trying to get the gangsters to do their homework and just anything, you know. My best friend was Puerto Rican, and she had a raging alcoholic father, and I remember, and there was a lot of violence, domestic violence in their home, and she would, when my dad was gone on these trips, she'd come and sneak into the house with me, and vice versa. I'd sneak out and go to her house, and we were very thick as thieves. We understood that that common bond out of terror, terror of a parent. So anyway, I'm here in this junior high, and I'm in this, I got selected to be in the Young Playwrights Project from being an honor student. Well, all summer I'd been hanging out with this gang who basically was torturing this girl that I didn't know about because I had to be in at a certain time and they didn't. And so I get called to the office out of this honors program, and there are all my friends, you know, with the police officer, and they start reading me my rights. Well, immediately the bluff was down. I was crying. They knew I was the weak link. They went right to me. And they're like, you better tell us everything. Well, first of all, they all got taken out in handcuffs because they were big, bad, and whatever. And I'm like, and I was just mortified that I was being taken from junior high in the police car. So they're like, oh, we don't need the handcuffs with her. So we get down to the station, and all they had to do was say, you better tell us everything or you're going to juvenile hall. And I was like, okay, this is how it happened. You know, and I gave all the details, and my friends were like, we're going to get you. And my best friend ended up doing time behind that. And she was really, I mean, that rage, there was one time, and she really did torture this girl, but this was alcoholism in her life. She had so much anger. I remember someone said, her name, she's fighting. They knew I was the best friend. I was the calmer one. And I remember having to jump in this crowd and pull her off this girl and show her, because she had blacked out from anger. Look what you're doing. You know, but there was me being the good friend, the good Al-Anon, even then, going to take care of the person. So I was guilty by association, and that's when it all hit with my mom. It's like, you're coming with me. And it was at the kitchen table with my mom, my dad, and he was like, where did you learn this behavior from? You know, all red face and about to lunge at me. And my mom was like, and he didn't like that too well. And it ended up, you know, we had to get out of there quick. So we were living with my mom, and she said, okay. And she tried to explain to me how I was in this gang too. And I was like, no, I'm not. This is the insanity, the double life, often the Al-Anons lead. You know, we got to look good on the outside and take care of the people. She's like, well, if you're hanging around with them and you're in these situations with them and you dress like them and you walk like them, how are you different? You're in a gang. And I was like, oh, wow. And she said, you're going to go to Alateen. And you're going to go for 6 months. And I was like, wow. And I kind of had a little ego around program, because I grew up in the meetings, I knew the lingo. I was like, okay, I can do this, you know. And I remember I was in Long Beach, California. That's where my journey in this program for me began. And it was on Long Beach Boulevard, a hospital there. There was an Alateen meeting. It was a treatment center. And I remember walking in there and just the love just hit you in the room. Was like tangible. They were sitting in a circle, and Alateen, I don't know if any of you have been to an Alateen meeting, but there's a lot of love in that room, and there's some magic that happens, just like what happens in a name meeting about a young person who's been affected by this disease being with other young people. Something counselors can't touch, parents can't touch. It is that identification, that thing that this program was founded on. They get it that young. They don't even, I mean, I've had the privilege to be an Alateen sponsor, and they don't even have to say anything. They just walk in the room, look at each other, and go, yeah, you get it. You get it. And I walked in there with my skin too tight and feeling overweight and feeling like, oh, I've let my mom down. And now I'm living in this weird place, and I don't know what to do. And people just loved me until I could love myself. And I got a sponsor. This was a very, and God had a plan for me, because I had, a big ego about, I know about all this. And landed me right smack in the middle of a group, an Alateen group that was very active in service. And I got active right away. Got a sponsor. I did my first inventory at 14. And you know how self-centered teenagers are. My inventory is like 25 pages. My mom was like, "You're not even old enough to have 25 pages of inventory." I'm like, "You don't know. You don't know me. You don't know what I've been through, you know?" And but I remember doing that. It was summer, and I was working at the Y where she worked, and she did this group for displaced homemakers, women who had no skills, and I was the child care person. I was working at age 11 and 12 and on up with her. I got my first jobs through her, and I remember these kids, a lot of them infected by drugs and alcohol too, bouncing off the walls, and I was right at home with that. So that was my brother. I was, you know, and I was a little caretaker. I was going to be a child psychologist when I grew up. I was going to figure it out. And I was going to help people. I always had an orientation to help people. But in Alateen, the distinction service, I was taught service. I was taught how to be of service from a spiritual place. I remember doing that inventory too, that 25-page inventory that had everything on there, from my childhood playmate who gave me her messed up Barbies to, you know, the sexual abuse that happened to my brother, the guilt with that, and that I couldn't protect him, and my anger at my dad for not being there, and my anger with my mom was so buried because she was my idol. It actually wasn't until I moved to Georgia. So anyway, I've gotten us to junior high, right? In Alateen, and with this group that's very active, did my fourth step, and I remember doing that first fifth step, and there were things I was going to take to the grave. And this is even growing up around you guys. I remember, to tell you little things, like my mom, my mom was raised in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She grew up here. You taught her how to parent. You know, you taught her how to be an adult, how to do finances. I mean, if you got to hear her story before mine, you would understand. So even without, I remember we'd be in the mall, and she'd be crazy in the morning, and she'd be like, sit us down in the middle of the mall. I mean, she was a little dramatic, too. I'm sure you guys didn't tell her that part, you know. But she was like, we're going to start our day over again, you know. And we'd be like, Mom, does it have to be so dramatic, you know. So we'd be sitting down in the middle of the mall, and we'd pray and start our day over again. Yeah. But things like that I laugh about now. I mean, I remember when she tried to teach us about the birds and the bees, you know. You guys all told her to do the research. And so, you know, and I was a little bright and advanced, and I got kicked out of the Brownies because I told everybody. She came home with the anatomy books and this and pictures and all this stuff, and she didn't know, and so she told me, and so I told them when they asked, you know. And the parents were like, we can teach our own kids about this. And my mom was like, well, you asked her. And I knew all the appropriate names, you know, for all the parts. And she never talked baby talk to us. I mean, she tells me stories about how, you know, her friends from AA would come over to the house, and they'd be like, you're so cute, you know, and she never talked to us like that. So we parrot that back. How are you doing today? Okay. And they were like so offended, you know, that they were like, what are you? Your kids have no manners, you know. And she didn't know. I mean, she just did what you guys told her to do, and she was doing the best she could, and she didn't talk to us like that. Well, and consequently, my brother and I, we have a good vocabulary because of that. And I love being around the adults too. And I think that's from growing up in meetings. But Alateen taught me how to be a kid, too, how to have a childhood. And I was in that group that got very active. I got to be on the committee for the Southern California Alateen Convention, SCAC. And that was a big honor back then. And we fundraised and did events all year to raise up you know, the money and get the word out and pick out the speakers. And, you know, it was Alateens put it on. And it was like 1,200 Alateens from all over California out of college. And it would happen every year. And it was amazing. I mean, the miracles that would happen there. And people from who'd been in the program for a while to that's their first, you know, you're going to this, their parents said. And they show up and all these Alateens and they just get dunked in the program. And it was like the love and the healing that took place there. And that day we were introduced to this simple kit of tools, so young. But, you know, I often like to tell people this because I would get this a lot when we would speak as a family. I wish I was you. I wish I got here so young. But you still got to pick up the kit. It says that in the big book. You got to pick up the kit and use it. And, you know, it wasn't until I hit the wall with doing it my way that I decided to do that. And so anyway, but and also got to mature around here. So that means my rebellion also happened in Alateen. So, you know, I was going along very well. And then I had more identity issues come up. Whoa, and you guys weren't going to get this. You know, I was not, this was the it where I was not going to fit in. This was going to be the one thing that was going to take me out. You know, bad enough that I was a white girl that wanted to be black. And, you know, that I had struggled with all that, and you loved me through that, you know, my anger with that and my journey to accepting myself and being comfortable in my skin, literally. So then about 11th grade, I discover I like girls, not boys. And that was a doozy. That was a doozy for me, for everyone, and I was sure that you all weren't going to accept me there. So I rebelled all the way to CODA. Left Al-Anon, you know, and I it was all me. And at that time, too, I cut my dad out of my life because he didn't have the right answer when I said that. And poor guy. I mean, he was from Tiffin, Ohio. Adopted this girl. First of all, she wants to date black boys. She wants to talk about liberal stuff. You know, he wanted me to date the captain of the football team and go to Notre Dame like a good little girl should. Be a cheerleader and do all that. And I remember clearly being, I don't know, 8 or 9, and he's crying at the Reagan speech. And I'm like, Mondale, Mondale. He's like, who are you? Who are you? Who is this little child? And, I mean, it's evidence of a higher power's sense of humor. You know, and I took him through a lot. I mean, he watched me go, and I remember he tried. He tried to know the rap group names, and, you know, and he would try to be understanding with me. But anyway, this took him over the top for a second, you know. But, of course, in my little head, it was like, my dad doesn't love me, and I made him wrong. And so I didn't talk to him for 5 years. And that almost killed me. Because I was still coming to meetings. I still had a sponsor. I was, you know, getting older, going to college. I want to tell another story, too, in college about using the 12 steps. Because now I started having a faculty with the 12 steps. So I came in about 12. So I have 21 years in this program. So I got to go through college with that. And I remember this job that I had, and I was, it was a new job, and I remember going to my sponsor that I'm so nervous. I'm, like, disproportionately nervous to start this new job. What is this? And you all taught me about inventory, and so I'm talking to my sponsor. We're doing the 10th step, and she reminds me of my inventory, where on my last job, I was stealing time. I was writing that I was coming in when I wasn't coming in, and I was leaving when I wasn't, you know, and I was justified, though. See, I was always justified because I was an excellent worker, and they didn't have a lot of work to do, and why did I have to be there if there was nothing to do? And, you know, and when I was there, I was great. And so, but what you all taught me is, like, the termites eat at the foundation, and that that stuff cuts me off from the sunlight of the spirit. And this is why I was so nervous. I was afraid to start this new job and start it all over again. The lying, cheating, and stealing, but I didn't want to call it that because I was justified. And, of course, you know, the lovely, gentle sponsors in Al-Anon, who she reminded me, Elise, have you made that amends yet to your last employer? I was like, what? She was like, yeah, I think this has something to do with that. And I was like, really, you think? She said, yeah, I really think you need to go do that before you start this new job. Oh, my God. You know, that was like the stories I read in the big book where, you know, they were going to go to jail, you know, or, you know, financial ruin. And I was like, this must qualify as, yeah, I don't need to make a direct amends here. You know, I could just make a living amends. I could just, you know, work extra hard on the next job. She was like, no, you need to go back. And so I prayed like I did before I came up here today. And I went back to that employer. And I explained what I had done. And I said, what can I do to make it right? And he was floored. I could call this man up. I haven't talked to him in 15 years. And he'd give me a recommendation. He was floored. And he's like, Elise, we knew what you were doing. But you were so good at what you... I said, see? No. But he was so impressed with me, and he said, wow. And, you know, I got to share a little bit, as he asked me, what's driving this, you know? And I got to share in a general way about what you all have taught me, the spiritual principles, and he was so impressed. But I got freedom, and I got a track record that I could do something like that and grow, and I started my new job and changed my life. That it wasn't about doing the right thing to be a good little girl. It was about being happy, joyous, and free. Because, see, I'm not an honest person because I want to be, or because that's my first thought, you know, or... I mean, I talk about having a criminal mind, you know, I can walk into a room and case the place, and, you know, and I still was like, why do you have to pay for makeup when they charge so much? But the difference is, you know, I tell people a lot that this program has me living out on the skinny branches of life. I mean, my life has gotten so huge from living this way of life that if I'm not connected to my source, I can't do it. I'm going to fall out of the tree. And so I can't keep that connection. I can't muddy that connection with all this stuff. And it is just simpler, and it becomes just easier to tell the truth and be honest and have compassion and love and look for the connection, look for the similarities and not the difference. I remember one time I'd tell the story again until I went to this meeting and I was like, they're cold. They're cold at that meeting. I told my sponsor, I don't like that meeting. And she's like, oh, I have something for you. I want you to go there and shake hands with 10 people and tell me how the meeting is after that. And I was so gullible, I didn't see. I was like, okay, do what I'm told. Because, you know, I was raised in old time in AA where you dressed up if you spoke, you thanked the speaker, and you never, you know, you did what you were told. That whole take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth, you know, and all of that. So I was trained well with that. So I went back to that meeting that I thought was cold, and I shook hands with 10 people, and I remember going, oh, they're so friendly, and they, you know, and they know me now, and she's like, yeah, you know, and I was totally just fell for it, you know, but that was to serve me well, that experience, because I've taken that, that's the thing, you know, I really, you know, it talks about in the big book, the fourth dimension of existence, being catapulted, and I'm living it. The promises have come true for me, continue to come true as long as I maintain a fit spiritual condition. And I got to travel and test it out that this really is a worldwide fellowship. I remember I graduated from college, and I wasn't going to go to, I mean, my dad told me in my 11th grade year that he wasn't going to pay for my college, this whole coming out thing and whatever. And so I basically willed myself into college. So anybody who says that us alcoholics and Al-Anons, we don't have willpower, oh, yeah, we do. You know, when it talks about in the book that that's a God-given thing if it's directed in the right place, you know, the proper use of the will, all that stuff. And so I use that also as a tracker, that when I set my mind to something, I can make it happen no matter what. Of course, God has sent people all along the way. And that job that I told you about making amends, that was, I got to, what I was doing was I was an academic advisor. And I was helping people with their schedule and organizing their time. And because that's another thing us Al-Anons. I mean, we can get you all set up, you know. We like to get you all set up. And we do it well, you know. And if you would just do what we say, then it would all turn out. And it's like giving, somebody told me, explained it, that it was like giving mouth to mouth to someone who's already breathing. You could kill somebody. You could kill somebody that way, you know. And so anyway, I'm floating along through here. And I haven't really even touched the whole romance part. That's where this disease really showed up for me. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. When I started to interact romantically, that was a doozy. That's where I continued to need this program. It's a lot easier to be spiritual when you're alone. And you get to have total control of your environment and everything you do. It's when you have other people come involved, you know, and we don't like that because our way is right. And we get a lot of reinforcement for our way being right. You know, I got a lot of pats on the back for being good. I mean, I'm an organizer, too. Like, I could do it professionally. I'm very organized. But when it comes to that, I remember, this is the insanity, too, of I'm going to show you. I remember I was dating somebody who was going through the police academy. Now, they have hours in the police academy. But I was taking everything personal. It was all about me. And I remember curling up in the fetal position next to the bed in a ball. She's asleep. Knocked out. But I was going to punish her. I mean, that's the insanity. Me being in a ball next to the bed was punishing her. I mean, this is how crazy we can get. We're standing at the window waiting for hours and hours, watching all the cars. You know, that whole... There was one thing, you know, there used to be this woman in Al-Anon in Long Beach, and she used to irritate me when I first came in because she wore a cowboy hat and had a convertible, and she would talk about, we are not a glum lot, and, you know, get a life, and all that. And I'm like, you obviously don't have the problems that I have. And she was just so happy. It was like you had to put your sunglasses on, you know, and I'm like, ugh. You know, and she would talk about joy and how the program was working in her life, and I was, and you know, it didn't escape me that she was single. But I'm told she went on to have successful relationships. But now I'm one of those people in the meetings where people are like, "Oh God, shut up!" You know, you are too happy. And I did get a life. I got off the floor, and I got, you guys taught me how to get a life, how to be my own event planner, you know, how to bring the romance if I wanted the romance, how to have a plan B, the Al-Anon plan B, you know, and I remember also thinking that when you came into Al-Anon, you left your alcoholic, I mean, you know, so I was, why wouldn't you? And I remember my first one of these roundups, and that there were these old-time women that, and one of them said, you know, I've learned I just don't talk to my husband after 1 o'clock in the afternoon because he's drunk by then. And I was like, you're still with your alcohol. You know, in my head, I was like, wow. And they've been together like 15 years of active alcoholism. And she was happy. And she had a life and she had friends and she was compassionate to that man who was an active alcoholic. And she embodied it, that it was a disease. And that she was going to love him the best she could, the time frames that she had. And I remember, and I wish I brought it with me, but it's the Alateen Do's and Don'ts, and I highly recommend it for everybody. But one of those is don't argue with an active alcoholic. And that just applies in about any situation when you're, you know, it doesn't even have to have alcohol involved, you know. Because I carry the ism with me wherever I go. So when I'm all agitated, that's not a good time to talk to me. And it's these little skills that you guys taught me, this way of life that I get to be happy, joyous, and free. Let me see. I'm kind of losing my train of thought here. So I was in college. Oh, I was going to tell you about the Worldwide Fellowship. So I graduate in 98 with my bachelor's in psychology. And by the way, my mom and I graduated together. And, you know, because I was mad at the dad, so I went so far as to change my last name. So we had the same last name, which now I see in hindsight God had a plan, because we got to graduate together. Like, literally, we had the same major, and so they announced her name, because her name's before me, Donna, and then mine, and we got a standing ovation. And she's an activist, too. I mean, she's a wheelchair user, and she fought to get a ramp at the graduation, and so she rolled across the stage, and I held her hand, and you see her. She has platinum white blonde hair, you know, buzz cut, and tan, and she's, I love my mom. And so we got to graduate together, but after that, I was going to go to London. I actually wanted to go somewhere else, but I had to do a work abroad program because I didn't have the money, and I found out you can't work somewhere where you don't speak the language. So I had to go either to Australia or London. I figured if I go to London, I'll be on the continent. I can travel at least. And so I went, and I remember walking up the thing where you're going onto the plane, and it hit me. You're going to a foreign country alone. But you all taught me how to have a plan and how to take God with me. Alateen taught me and Al-Anon. So I was like, all right, God, we're going. And I remember going into the little teeny bathroom, the little lavatory, and going, okay, God, you're going to come back with me to my seat. You know, I call my higher power God. For convenience now, I've done the whole feminist thing, and it's not he, it's she, and, you know, I've calmed down a little, and, you know, with the whole, again, identity issue of God. Now, it doesn't matter to me. I just, God, because you all get what God means. Higher power of my own understanding. Anyway, I said, come back with me to my seat. And from that moment, I was sitting next to someone, and she helped me get off and get on the tube, and I was never alone the entire trip. God sent me angels, and I found you all there. I found an Al-Anon meeting, and they called me California when I was there, and I wanted to hug everybody, and they're like... And they had a weird version of the closing, you know, in Al-Anon. I love our closing, where it says, well, you know, you may not like all of us, but you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. In London, it was, we'll have warmth for you. And I laughed out loud when they said that. And they didn't even clap or anything. And you guys don't clap in Georgia. I'm from California, Hollywood, I guess. Everybody claps after everybody. And so they just really enjoyed me while I was there. But there was two major miracles that happened on that trip. First one is the mystique of sponsorship was lifted, because they were like, okay, how long are you going to be here, Marino? It's California. I said, well, you know, about 2 months. Do you have a sponsor? And I was like, what do you mean? Because my mom had the same sponsor, Beth Ann, for her whole life. And there was a lot of sponsor worship in California. You know, you had to have just the right one. And so I, of course, no one could live up to my mom or her sponsor. And so I suffered from self-sponsorship for a long time. In my young adulthood, it was not pretty. And it really got me to the point where, you know, because I am vivacious, as was introduced and all this, that I was like the walking wounded, the one that everyone thought, oh, she has it together, she's good. And that's Elise, and she came from Alateen, and they spoke as a family, and she has no issues, and I didn't get any help or anybody reaching out to me. And it was my own stuff, because I could put up a good front. But London, they were like, no, you need a temporary sponsor now. And it doesn't matter. So-and-so, they're available. There's your sponsor while you're here. And I was like, whoa, you know, and it really, and everybody had a sponsor, and it wasn't this big deal, and you could change it if it didn't work. And I learned a lot about sponsorship. And, you know, later, and I've done research about this, and I got to hear Joe and Charlie actually here, and they talk about the history and how Bill would just, he would go to different people that had an expertise about whatever he was dealing with. It didn't have to be one person that had all the answers. And it was really, you know, based on how can we work the steps around this. Not being my mommy, my therapist, my love I never got, you know. And really just guiding me through the principles of this program. And I learned that first there. That was one miracle. Got to have sponsorship. The other thing was I missed my train to Scotland. And, of course, I was upset. I was so upset. So, but I had, because I gotten the schedule, found out where you are. I saw that there was this little convention roundup there, AA Al-Anon Alateen, and because you all taught me to thank the speaker after the Alateen spoke, because I missed the other two, I had gotten there late, I went up and thanked the Alateen speaker, and she was so thrilled. She was new in Alateen, and she was like, "You're from California," and, you know, Baywatch, and I was like, "No." But I found out there that Baywatch and Jerry Springer were representing California. That was scary in London. But anyway, she wanted to have me over for tea, and I went over because you all taught me to do that. And I ended up staying with them. They had a spare room. But then I was to find out why I was really there. And why I was really there was because the Alateen made it to Alateen and the AA made it to AA, and they were falling in love and having the same spiritual language, and everybody was so happy. And the Al-Anon was seething. She was so angry and so hurt and so displaced. And I really got to 12-step her. I really got to be an attraction rather than a promotion. And she would ask me about where I was going every day, because I went to a meeting every day when I was there. And I would take the train, and that was going to be one of her barriers, because she couldn't go in her town because they all knew her. And it's true. Everybody knew everybody at the meeting. But she saw I could get on the train and go to the city and go to these meetings, and I took her to her first Al-Anon meeting. And she didn't have to carry around that anger anymore. You know, and she's like, "I'm only staying with him because of her." And, you know, it can feel that way sometimes. You know, I held it all together, and now he's her hero, and she doesn't know because I shielded her from all this stuff, you know, and that whole, the victim and the martyr and no way out of that. And I just got to listen to her and love her and take her to people that could help her get through that. That was my experience. I mean, then, and since then, I'm a firm believer in everywhere I go, find a meeting. And I love doing that. I love to. In fact, I get teased for doing that now. are we going to find the meeting wherever we're at? Yes. You know, the other thing is all my traditions around holidays are with meetings. Because you guys are my family, so, and it's even been kind of wacky sometimes, you know, like having the Thanksgiving with the, you know, the newcomers, and trying to put a meal together with that. Al-Anon's and AA's at a potluck could be scary sometimes. But, you know, that's what we did. We opened our home to Alcoholics and Al-Anons around the holidays. That was my growing up. Let's see, what else can I tell about you? Oh, coming full circle. So, I didn't want to go to that room where the Al-Anons were when I was old enough, my transition, because you guys were just old ladies who knit. And, you know, in Alateen, we were cool, and we sat on the floor and gave each other massages and, you know, went to campouts and dances. And there was a time. There is some, you know, that young adulthood transition where you really kind of don't feel fit in. And I've seen that here with young people's AA, how strong and powerful it is to have that identification. There is different issues you deal with at different ages. But I did make my transition, and Al-Anon, and then moving here, that was the other thing. Here, when I arrived, I hated Atlanta. I hated Georgia. You guys, first of all, no one knows a street name. I was like, "Can you just tell me the street?" They'd be like, "No, you know, it's after the QT and over by the Kroger," and, you know, and then if they did know a street name, it was three streets ago, the name. What it used to be like, or what was named 10 years ago. Like Bankhead. Bankhead is not Bankhead. Donald Lee Halliwell. But anyway, and the other thing is how it would change. I mean, you can drive from Canada to Mexico on Pacific Coast Highway in California. Not here. They change. So I was, and of course your meetings, they were only an hour. You didn't clap. You know, it was all wrong. But it was a miracle for me because I was anonymous, really completely anonymous. And, you know, part of this is I encourage and suggest that we keep reaching out to the newcomers. And I'm guilty of this too. I love my peeps, and I want to be in my little clique. But, and also about thinking that the old timers have it handled. They don't. They need this program. I need this program. So it was a gift to be a nobody again, to not have a name or reputation, to have people embrace me here, and to be that level of humility where I needed help. I needed help to get through. And you guys embraced me. And my home group today is the Leslie Women Forget Al-Anon group at the NAMA Club in Atlanta. I love that meeting. I highly recommend it. You're all invited if you're female, that is. Although we've had men show up a couple times, they get real quickly, I'm in the wrong. But there's a men's meeting earlier. We start at 12:35, and the men's meeting is at, I think, 9:30. And I got a sponsor here, and I've done some real work with this sponsor. Remember I told you I suffered from self-sponsorship for a long time, meaning I would take fifth step hostages. You know, I've written the fourth step. I need to do the fifth step. You know, which, I mean, you got to do it. I mean, it's part of doing the deal. But it does help to have somebody who knows you, you know, who can guide you through the rest, too. You know, because I remember my sponsor this time around says, you know, there is 6 through 12. I'm like, yeah. Okay. You know? So I got to do all the steps in order with her, and it's been such a gift. And part of that is I got to get angry at that alcoholic, my mom, who was my idol. And I was so afraid to get angry at her. It was so much easier to get angry at my dad. I'll tell you my dad's story, too. This was actually from one of the fifth step hostages I took, but she was good. She was a double winner. She was AA Dottie. AA and Al-Anon. And I did my fifth step, and I was in so much pain about my dad, but I was so clueless that I was in so much pain from not talking to him for 5 years, and I was going to, you know, be right about that. And I remember after she's heard it, you know, ad infinitum, she goes, okay, Elise, it's time to get off the cross. We need the wood. You love your dad. You need to go make that amends. And she said, I remember when I was at this place in my recovery, and my sponsor told me, this was one of those little stories that they say when they're really trying to get a point across to you. She said, well, what my sponsor did was she stopped listening to anything else until I did that amends. Hint, hint, you know? And I was like, dang, you know, I really got to do this. So I remember calling my dad and saying, I mean, out of the blue, like I had to track down his number. And saying, I want to see you. And being terrified to do it. And I remember Scott at the driveway, and I called my sponsor. I'm like, I'm here. What do I do? You know, and she told me this whole story about how we've walked the path before you, and we're on the other side. And reaching out, like kind of what the poem was shared, and I'm going to be here for you on the other side, and God's going to be with you. And all you got to do is knock on the door, say hello, and God will do the rest. And that was hard to get out of the car and knock on the door. But I did. And she was right. Turned out my grandfather was there, too. And my dad was so amazing. You know, I thought he had changed. It was really me. I had softened, but I remember it involved. I mean, Hallmark couldn't have written it better. I mean, there was a porch swing and my head in his lap. I mean, just telling me he's proud of me and listening, and both of us crying. And it was, I mean, he listened to everything, and I was able to finally listen to him. You know, and I said, well, what about this? What about when I brought this report card home? And he was able to say, you know, I didn't mean that, you know, and the whole gay thing, he was like, I was over it a long time ago, you know, it just, you had to give me a minute. That was a lot to handle. And my dad is my friend today. And, you know, I still grieve that we didn't have, you know, the lifetime story of father, daughter, but we have something very special, and I am daddy's little girl. I was, and that's why my heart was so broken. And there's so much healing that came out of that, you know, 5 minutes of excruciating terror. And, you know, I tell you that because there's so much on the other side of that. There's so much when we show up and do it. And, you know, I learned here that courage is not the absence of fear. You know, that courage is acting in the face of fear. And I think we're all courageous here because we do that all the time. I mean, the speaker shared last night about that, and I see it with the people I sponsor. You know, I got to sponsor this man through a divorce, and he got to do the divorce with grace. But his main thing was his teenager. He was terrified of her, you know. And we can be scary. And I got so, I mean, God just showed me, wow, I was such a brat. I was a brat and a lot to deal with. And just the compassion, though, for myself, for my dad, for what they were dealing with at that time. And then the full circle is I got to sponsor Alateens. And what a blessing. What a miracle that was. And, you know, and recently I've, just again, a lesson in powerlessness and a lesson about how this disease does ravage our lives. It really does. I found out that, and this is even in sobriety. You know, and there's a joke, stay around AA long enough, because the qualification for Al-Anon is if someone's drinking or sobriety bothers you. So 6 degrees of separation, we all qualify for Al-Anon. And I used to say to people, you know, why don't you do that family tree and find the alcohol? Because this is the best free help you can ever get, you know. Because I actually am in the helping profession. And you guys have taught me how to deal with some of the ugliness of humanity with love and compassion. And I really get that hurt people, you know. And sometimes I've just presenced that in a room with all these professionals that know better. We got the degrees in social work and psychology and this and that. And we forget. We forget. And even in drug court, even people who are in the profession of recovery forget. And I think it gets on you. This disease gets on you, and you got to be reminded that perspective, you know, hurt people. And I remember my sponsor used to call me two things, fear with legs sometimes, and head on a stick. And she'd be like, get back in your body. Yeah. You know? And there's a saying in Alateen, you know, like, be where your feet are. You know, and I just heard another version of that is wiggle your toes. I love that. Wiggle your toes. When you're having problems staying in the present, just wiggle your toes and be right where your feet are. Because, you know, usually there's nothing wrong in the present. And you all taught me the distinction. I remember I had to do this for a month. This is one of my assignments. Write down your fears and write, are they real or imagined? Real or imagined? You know, most of my fear was imaginary because, I mean, my sponsor had to lay out what is a real fear because I didn't get it at first. You know, this is like you're in a dark alley and someone is actually behind you. You know, that is real fear. The rest, you know, something there where there's a real stimulus. Most of our fear is imagined, you know, and it talks about that in the big book. We're riddled with fear, and that the antidote to that is faith and connection with higher power and with you all. God with skin on. I heard that here, too. I never heard that till Georgia. You're my God with skin on. Because wrapping your head around that concept of a higher power, even if you've looked in all the places I've looked for that higher power, is hard to do. Because sometimes you just need a hug. You know? And also, though, I've had those moments now, those abstract moments. Like, I like to think of, you know, those unexpected moments when the sun touches your face. To me, that's a hug from God. Also, when just the right song comes on the radio. I remember in Alateen, we did a meeting on what's your higher power, and one of them said, the music in my earphones, that's my higher power, because I don't hear the fighting, and I can relax. But recently, one of the Alateens I got really close to, and she's a powerhouse. She got here when she was 9, too. But this disease lives on, even in sober members. And her father was a good member of AA. And but she came of age, and she was one of those knucklehead teenagers. And I just found out she ended up, you know, in out-of-home care, in foster care, the violence in the home. And this is with her. She's 14, and she's been in the rooms since 9. And I think her dad has over 15 years sober. But that was that same thing. It was like this karmic do-over that I get to be a loving presence in this because her dad is a single dad, too. And doing the best he can, even with this fellowship. And And she's a handful. She is a bloody handful. And so was I. I mean, getting arrested and crazy. And so, again, to have compassion and to do what I can. And Al-Anon, you know, has taught me that I can't always fix it. That's not my job to fix it. But the loving witness on the journey, how valuable is that? And to give people the dignity to walk their own path. You all taught me that. With my brother, I often think, you know, I'm not in active alcoholism, but my brother is an active alcoholic and drug addict. And because he's functional, I'm often in denial about that. And it's really heartbreaking because he has this program too deep within him. He was active in Alateen. But now, you know, he's living in that alcoholic trailer with no running water and, you know, isolated and crazy. And I can't even talk to him on the phone because he just rages at me. And it's just, it's so sad. I really have little to no relationship with him, and it just breaks my heart. But you all have taught me that he's on his path and he has a higher power, and that prayer is powerful. That prayer does change things and makes a difference. And to trust the seeds of this program within him and give him the dignity to walk his own path. And my mom, she lets me share what her Al-Anon bottom was. She was kind of always been in AA for 31 years, but in and out of Al-Anon, not really taking it seriously. But she likes to share that her Al-Anon bottom is when one day she was throwing lemons at my brother. This is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous who sponsors people. Throwing lemons at my brother, saying, if you would just listen to me and do it my way, da, da, da. You know, and she had been to enough Al-Anon to know that was a big slip. Huge. Not what you should be saying to an active alcoholic addict. And I remember she shared this with me, and it really sums it up. My brother just looked at her with those eyes that were talked about and said, Mom, Mommy, we call her Mommy, there's nothing you could say to me that is worse than what I say to myself. You know, it's like what I read here. And it just hit her. She just started crying, you know, like, wow, you know, he's sick and I'm just judging him and trying, thinking I know what's best. And he's suffering. And my brother, he does. I mean, he'll call me back after these raging conversations and go, I'm glad you hung up because I didn't want to do that. And that's another thing you all taught me. When we take care of ourselves, we prevent somebody who's out of control having to feel guilty later for what they're doing. I've been thanked many times by people that for taking care of myself, that you didn't, I mean, and even when I got to work with the Alateens or in my profession, me taking care of myself prevents them. I remember one time my mom told me that too, about being disrespectful to her. She said, I'm stopping you from doing this, not because of me. I'm an adult. I know I'm going to be fine because of you and how it's going to hurt you later when you realize you've disrespected your mother. And I've never forgotten that. Like, wow, you know, when we stand up for ourselves and we take care of ourselves in an appropriate way, it prevents that. It prevents somebody being out of control over us. And he said that to me. And so it helps me when I need to hang up the phone, when he's calling me and upset, or I try to reach out to him and he rages at me. I have no idea how much time I've talked, so just tell me here. What else can I tell you about me? Oh, I got to meet that mom who gave me up. Another thing is, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and my mom's willingness to be teachable, they did all the research about how to handle adoption. And back then, in the 70s, I was born in 75, you know, they weren't doing open adoptions. But they told me all growing up that my mom really loved and cared for me, and that she was very mature even at 15. That, again, she hid her pregnancy because she knew that her parents would make her have an abortion, and she took really good care of her body. And this is how I was raised. So I never had any malice or ill feelings toward my biological mother. And I remember when I turned 18, I was graduating high school, and I get this call. And she had called, and I was, again, estranged from my dad. That was the beginning of the estrangement. But my dad called me and said, your birth mom has, her dad has contacted me and she wants to meet you, wants to talk to you. And I was like, and at that time she was estranged from her dad too. But I, because I had Alateen at that time and I got to talk to her and be myself and share with her. And it turned out like it's in the blood, the whole interracial thing. She was married to a black man and I had biracial, you know, biological brothers and sisters. And she got to tell me her story and I got to tell her mine and we got to meet. And then I also got to see that, you know, she was still very much affected by this disease. Her dad got sober, but they never went to Al-Anon. She never went. And so she was chain smoking on Prozac and overweight and not happy. And she also didn't have a healthy relationship toward me. You know, as I was raised with the healthy version, she had this fantasy that we were going to be mother and daughter and that, you know, she would meet me at age 18 and we would live happily ever after. And I was an Alateen. I'd been raised around, I knew about healthy boundaries. I knew who my parents were. And so I was like, whoa, slow down, you know? And really, I think I could have dealt with it more, except that she had kids that she was saying, this is your sister. And we were supposed to have this instant sibling bond. And they're looking and and I'm looking like, we don't even know each other. And she started introducing me as her daughter. And all this, it just got really weird. And I saw how, when she came and heard me speak, she lived in Bakersfield and I was asked to be the Alateen speaker. And she came and heard me speak, but I don't think she heard what I said. All she heard was her own pain that she had never dealt with. And she came up to me, I'm so sorry I gave you to people that were, you know, alcoholic. And I was like, you missed the whole talk. You know, I love my mom. She was sober. She gave me this way of life, you know. All this. And I think, you know, she was just reactivated by all the stuff that she never dealt with her dad. And so we had that, you know, kind of ended our, and I remember going back from there and writing her this letter saying, you know, I need to take it back a step. You all taught me I could take care of myself. She had a lot of expectation. It was a very loaded relationship. And I wrote this very loving letter, run it by my sponsor. You know, I'd like us to correspond, you know, written, and we'll work up to a relationship, you know, which was healthy. And she didn't hear that. She heard that I was mad at her for giving me up for adoption and all this stuff. And then you guys taught me that that was her, that I didn't have to feel guilty for that, and that I did what I did. And so I released her. I kind of released it to God, like, if we're ever supposed to have a relationship. And I found out about, it's been a while now, about 8 years ago, that she was out on the streets using, drinking and using. And she's got it in both sides of the family. She's got the gene. So I just pray for them, and I pray for my half-brothers and sisters. Because, you know, actually, I work for the system now, and I got to be an adoption worker, actually. I'm talking about full circle. God is so great. I just got an email inviting me to, so I'm not a direct case manager anymore, but I got an email inviting me to a finalization of adoption where I did a lot of the work to make it happen. The adoptive mom wants me to be there when she's adopted, and, anyway, so they're just, because I stuck around, you know, because I show up and put one foot in front of the other. And I take it so for granted sometimes. Because, you know, I'll be in my professional life or whatever, and I'll say something that we all say in here all the time, and it's so profound. You know, it's so profound for them, and I'm like, if you only knew, you know. And like I said, even with people who are around this recovery, I mean, I brought a panel to the court where I work. They were floored. You know, no one thought about the effects on the family. I brought Alateens and Al-Anons, and I brought the literature. And they were so hungry for it. And even the women who were in drug court, you know, who are the addicts and the alcoholics, they were just, wow, that there's a way my family could heal, that there's a way the effects of what I've done, that they could be healed. And I think that's the time. But I can't believe I talked this long. I just, again, I owe my life and the quality of my life to you all and to these rooms and to the principles of this program, and I'm a lifer. Thanks for letting me share.